As you might know, Nuremberg has more than 600 years of tradition as a city of toys. Production and trade in toys are an integral part of the city's general industrial history, but with their strong export orientation, Nuremberg wares are at the same time an important part of Europe's cultural history of toys. Nuremberg's toy tradition stretches from medieval doll makers to numerous tin plate toy producers in the industrial age and to the international toy fair of today. The Nuremberg Museum regards itself as an essential part of this rich regional heritage. Its collection reflects the regional tradition within the wider context of the German and international toy tradition. The museum's treasures span the time from antiquity to the present day, with a strong focus on the past two centuries. The museum goes back to the enthusiasm and the expertise of Lydia Bayer. Supported by her husband Paul, she started collecting toys in the early 1920s, at a time when hardly anyone was aware of the cultural relevance of toys. The Bayers mainly collected dolls, dolls' houses, shops, wooden toys, but also tin plate toys, children's books, and games. The large collection survived the air raids of World War II, safely stored away in more than 20 different places outside the Nuremberg area. In 1962, shortly after the death of Lydia Bayer Senior, her husband and her daughter Lydia established a private toy museum in Würzburg. 4 years later, however, they sold their collection to the city of Nuremberg, which planned to set up a communal toy museum. The city administration planned to build and maintain this toy museum, and to do so, they bought a stately patrician building located in the very heart of the city, and this once had even housed a toy trading company. The museum was converted, the building was converted into a museum in a couple of years, and under the direction of Lydia Bayer, the museum was opened in 1971. Right from the beginning, the museum was a great success. More than 5 million people from all over the world have visited the museum so far. Due to its enormous popularity, the museum has experienced 3 major extensions over the years. The indoor exhibition space has doubled from 600 to 1,200 square meters. More than 4,000 objects are on permanent display. During the summer months, a large outdoor playing area, the museum's vaults, and a cozy garden cafe offer an additional 1,000 square meters of fun and playful education to the public. Now I would like to take you through a tour through the museum, and of course we start off with the ground floor. The ground floor mainly concentrates, apart from the special exhibition rooms and the lobby, on wooden toys. Wood is a material easy to find, easy to work with, pleasant to the touch, and lending itself to many different designs. It seems logical to start a tour through a toy museum with a look into the history of wooden toys, but we also have some examples of toys that date back to ancient Greece and Rome and are not made from wood, for instance, like these fragments of a Corinthian clay doll or a beautiful Roman pull-along pigeon from the first century Anno Domini. Of special importance to the history of Nuremberg toys are a number of molded clay dolls. They are the oldest toys of local origin that have survived the centuries and can be dated back to the late 14th and early 15th century. In Germany, commercial production of wooden toys started in the 16th century. It developed mainly in the forested areas of the Alps, of Thuringia and the Ore Mountains. All those regions are represented with their characteristic products: animals, houses, stables, toy soldiers, and miniature vehicles can be found, as well as building blocks or Noah's Arks. Toys from these regions were internationally distributed by Nuremberg merchants as Nuremberg wares. But wooden toys were also manufactured in Nuremberg itself. The museum section includes turned and finely painted miniature dishes, well-known city buildings, or even balancing toys like this delicate tightrope walkers made by the Nuremberg company Baudenbacher around 1880. Around 1900, the art education movement demanded that toys should stimulate the imagination of children instead of becoming ever more realistic and technically detailed. Therefore, artists developed new wooden toys with reduced shapes and clear, bright colors. Special workshops in Dresden, in Vienna, and Munich took up the designs of avant-garde artists like Ferdinand Andry, Emmy Zweibrück, or Richard Riemerschmid. They produced wonderful new toys in limited editions for an educated and well-off elite. Their design ideas eventually became guiding principles for later generations of wooden toy makers. Now, let me take you one stair up into the first floor, which is dedicated basically to the topics of family and play. And therefore, you will find there dolls, houses, kitchens, and figures, for instance. Traditional educational concepts aimed at preparing little girls for their role as mistress of the household through play. While at first dolls' houses were basically meant to be showpieces and demonstration objects in upper-class families, they eventually became objects to be played with. In this room, a series of dolls' kitchens uses examples from four centuries to show how precisely household management was modeled in its various regional and social forms. Of special interest is a typical example of a Nuremberg-style kitchen from the 18th century with its central open hearth, the geometrical tile pattern, and the dominance of pewter, copper, and brass utensils. Further examples show how the technical improvements of kitchen furnishing during the age of industrialization are reflected in the toy kitchens. The open fireplace was replaced by cooking ranges heated by wood, coal, gas, and finally electricity, like you can see here on this picture, which is one of the very first electric stoves that was built by the German firm of Märklin. Finally, market stalls and grocer shops round off this household management section in the museum. One large room is dedicated to the history of dolls and dolls' houses in Germany since the 18th century. The dolls' houses of our collection cover a time period from Biedermeier via historism and Art Nouveau up to the 1940s. They not only document a change in lifestyle, but they also draw a vivid picture of bourgeois family life. Well-assorted fashion shops are also highly relevant cultural documents, as can be seen in this example from the 1880s. The development of dolls reflects the history of fashion and the changes in the ideals of beauty. In the 18th and early 19th century, dolls were not just toys. They also served as fashion models for ladies. Girls were supposed to learn that a major part of their later lives was to be dedicated to caring for a fashionable wardrobe. Thus, fashion dolls served as examples of the latest fashion worn in capitals like Paris. In Germany, Thuringia, with Sonneberg as its toy capital, became the undisputed center of doll production in the 19th century. Numerous dolls made from papier-mâché and porcelain were exported all over the world. Under the influence of changing fashions, their appearance eventually became more childlike, but the use of a highly breakable material like porcelain limited the possibilities of intense playing with these dolls. Around 1900, educational reformers demanded artistically valuable dolls made from soft, natural materials suited to the needs of children. And pioneers like Margarete Steiff and Käthe Kruse, yes, you have a nice example of a Kruse doll here, realized these new concepts of doll children made from fabric and textiles. The Steiff company is best known for the invention of the teddy bear, which came on the market in 1902. This outstanding contribution of this highly innovative company to the history of soft toys is documented by an arrangement of showcases, which is inspired by the glass and iron structure of the Steiff factory, built in 1903. Many of these objects come from the Steiff archives, and they give a good overview of the development of the Steiff range between the 1890s and the year 2000. The only room which has been preserved from the original historical building is adorned by a beautiful Rococo stucco ceiling. It is dedicated to the tiny world of tin figures. Starting in the late 18th century, Nuremberg and the neighboring town of Fürth became famous for their enormous variety of flat tin and three-dimensional lead figures. Dozens of workshops produced millions upon millions of these tiny figures, which rose to an enormous popularity until World War I. At first, they depicted mainly civilian scenes, followed later on by military topics. Thus, they reflected the growing militarism and imperialism of the major European nations. The catastrophe of the First World War ended the era of the tin figure as a toy. It was replaced, however, by the larger and less expensive figurines made from composition materials. The only exhibition room which is entirely dedicated to the history of one single toy company tells the fascinating story of E.P. Lehmann. Founded by Ernst-Paul Lehmann in Brandenburg near Berlin in 1881, the creative design and innovative mechanism of his toys soon gained the company a worldwide reputation. Whether technical or figurative toys, Lehmann's products were always characterized by inventive mechanism, playful ideas, witty names, and an unfailing sense for the spirit of the times. Many toys, such as the climbing monkey Tom, the dancing sailor, or the balking mule, were so popular that they remained on the market unchanged for decades. After World War II, the owners of the company were expropriated by the communist government and had to start anew in Nuremberg under very difficult circumstances. Their economic breakthrough came with the launching of the LGB model train in 1968, which was to become the most popular large-scale model railway in the world. In 2006, however, the company ran into financial difficulties and had to close its production facilities in Nuremberg. With over 300 objects, this exhibition room stages the world's most comprehensive collection of Lehmann tin toys. Nearly all of the objects were loans from the company, and when the firm went bankrupt, there was a very strong threat that the collection would be auctioned to settle demands of creditors. A few weeks ago, however, we were able to buy the whole collection with the help of private sponsor and public funds, and we are very happy to have this collection now permanently in our museum. Now let's go on to optical toys. This small museum section gives a fascinating glimpse of the attractive world of optical toys. Until the end of the 19th century, a wealth of long-forgotten media satisfied the visual curiosity of children and adults alike. Among these media were shadow and paper theaters, peep shows, or magic lanterns. Small-scale variations of these, many of them manufactured in Nuremberg, provided entertainment and education for bourgeois families. After about 1850, stereoscopic photography brought a new quality of three-dimensional representation, and with zoetrope, magic drum, and proxenoscope, pictures gradually started moving too. Now, follow me up the spiral staircase onto the second floor, and this floor is dedicated mainly to work and technology as their main topics. Exhibits include mainly metal toys, such as steam engines, train sets, cars, ships, planes, and mechanical figures. A large model train layout in gauge S is particularly remarkable. Important technical innovations have been fascinating children and adults alike right from the beginning, so that corresponding toys almost simultaneously appeared to the inventions. In times when people believed in technical progress, children, mainly boys, of course, in this respect, were supposed to learn about modern technology in play in order to be well prepared for the future. From simple penny toys to metal construction sets, dancing figures, fully functional steam engines, and model train sets, an entire world was fashioned from tin. And for a century, Nuremberg was its capital. Around 1910, about 5,000 people were employed here in more than 100 companies, among the well-known names such as Ismayer, Hess, Boop, Carette, Fleischmann, Planck, Doll, and most importantly, Bing, then the world's largest manufacturer of toys. In the 20th century, other major companies were established like Schuko, Trix, Gamma, Arnold, or Distler. Samples of their vast range can be seen in this section of the museum. Playing with metal construction sets was one of the main preoccupations of boys throughout the 20th century. Numerous engineers learned the basics of technology by playing with Meccano, Märklin, Trix, or Walter Stabil. A special display with large drawers presents a wealth of construction sets and beautiful models manufactured by these four companies. And finally, we go up to the top floor, and this is dedicated to the most recent developments, toys since 1945. In six time stations and with over 40 toy chests, this section paints an entertaining panorama of toy development from the makeshift toys of rubble, the rubble years to the high-tech toys of today. The basic idea behind this kind of presentation is that toys are perfect mirrors of their times. And therefore, they can also be regarded as a means of telling history. In this museum section, toys typical of their times are presented like actors on a historical stage. Theater-like dioramas present scenes shaped and illustrated by toys, which we regard as perfect witnesses of the chosen decade. This journey of through time starts off with the rubble years. Against the panoramic backdrop of the heavily destroyed city of Nuremberg, ruins built from anchor stones can be seen. A small gauge railway built of a metal construction system and a handmade toy truck are carrying away the rubble. Right next to this scene, toys from the Nazi years are shown, which were meant to indoctrinate the German youth in the 1930s. Thus, the connection between the war preparation of the Nazi regime and the following destructions of war is visualized. A second example might illustrate this method of toy storytelling. The 1950s in Germany are characterized by the fast reconstruction of the economy. New ideas of architecture, often influenced by American examples, were realized stone by stone. And the cities were rebuilt according to the needs of a fast-growing traffic. Modernization was the great theme of the 1950s, and accordingly, building blocks like Lego bricks, as well as small die-cast or plastic cars, were the toys of the decade. And with similar dioramas of that kind, we are tracing our way through the toy jungle up to the year 2000. Parts of our large Schuko collection are presented in a more traditional way. Mechanical figures, cars, and soft toys made by Schuko in the 1950s and 60s can be seen in a display reminding of a toy fair stand of the time. Many objects were saved directly from the former showroom of the company after its bankruptcy in 1976. Right next to this section, we come to the play area. Children's play area. Children are the most important people in this play area. A large, artistically styled room invites small visitors to try out a wealth of board games and games of skills, or to experiment with various systems of building sets. They may paint and do handicrafts, and even make the stars rise in the sky on the push of a button. A trained educationalist assist children in making use of the many different play possibilities presented by this room. During the weekends, special events and workshops are taking place here, including the telling of fairy tales, magic lantern shows, board game testing, and workshops for making historic toys. Very popular are, of course, birthday parties for children. Now let's move down 4 floors and go into the outdoor area of the museum. The latest extension of the museum in 2006 resulted in several new attractions on a site adjacent to the museum. A large outdoor playground, the shadow land in the late medieval cellar walls underneath, the museum's cafe in the historical courtyard, and a large LGB garden train layout. Between May and October, these new facilities are available to our visitors. The playground is dominated by a large reproduction of the famous painting Children's Games by Peter Bruegel the Elder from 1560. You just see a picture as it was mounted. For many visitors, a closer look at this painting serves as a starting point for the exploration of the playground. Under the heading Play in Former Times, little ones, guided by our expert staff, may have hands-on play experience and try out long-forgotten games from grandmother's times. There are also historical amusements such as Russian skittles or classic hopscotch games which may be tried out here. Children may follow the course of wooden balls on a big ball track fashioned from oak trunks or even explore a hedge labyrinth. The museum's unit, Shadowland, lures visitors into late medieval cellar walls. In the course of a 30-minute guided tour, visitors may find out why playing with light and shade have always fascinated people and has led to the development of a great variety of optical toys. And finally, the idyllic museum courtyard features the museum's cafe. It invites people for a leisurely break while the trains of a lovely LGB train layout are doing their rounds. Now, this is the end of the tour through the museum, but I want to tell you also a little bit about the collection itself and our collection policies. Since its foundation in 1966, the museum collection has grown enormously. The number of objects has risen from about 15,000 objects to around 85,000 objects. This growth is mainly due to donations, loans, and to a lesser extent, purchases. As only 5% of all items are on permanent display, large parts of the collection cannot be shown. Of course, not everything is fit for display, what is in the collection, but there are important types of toys which are not at all present in the museum. For instance, paper toys, board games, children's books, or toys of non-European origin. For the time being, this cannot be helped as a further extension of the museum is not in sight at the moment. The restrictions of space and money have influenced our collecting policy. While my predecessor was a natural-born collector, my guideline is rather quality instead of quantity. This applies to the acquisition of single items as well as of whole collections. In my view, the most important aspect of this kind of targeted collecting is a close partnership with private collectors. Therefore, it has always been our aim to work with serious collectors and to give them a forum for their collections. We often stage special exhibitions on the basis of a private collection supplemented by items from our own stock. Sometimes we even write and publish books on these collections. Thus, large parts of the collections involved are documented. Of course, we always bear in mind that by doing so, we might open up a favorable perspective for the future of these collections in our collection. Over the years, close collaboration with collectors has enabled us to draw valuable to draw valuable collections into the museum either on a permanent loan, by donation or by purchasing. It goes without saying that a close and long-standing personal relation with a collector helps enormously when he or she ponders what to do with a collection. Collectors do appreciate a professional approach towards their collection. Here we have an example of a private collection of miniature toys as I found it when I met this person. This is the way he presented it in his living room, and there were a number of people that wanted to buy his really excellent collection. There was also someone from Christie's had been there and had a look at it, and all the other large museums were interested in obtaining this collection. And I promised him, if you give it to us, pay you a decent price, but we can promise you that within 1 year we will catalogue your collection and we will stage an exhibition. And this finally made it. And so 1 year later, we showed his collection in our exhibition room, and he was very, very happy to see his collection once in a lifetime presented in a way like he would have loved to do it. Collectors really love to see their objects nicely staged in an exhibition, and most of them like to get public attention. And above all, they want to place their collection in trustworthy hands once they have to part with their treasures. Financial aspects are sometimes secondary when it comes to permanently securing a collection, and a transfer to a museum still seems to be the safest option for most collectors. And the genesis of the Nuremberg Toy Museum itself is a very good example for that. By following this general policy, we have been able to acquire a number of valuable additions to our collections. For example, the collection I've just talked about, the miniature toys from the Ore Mountains. Then we obtained a very large collection of English children's books, which were all published by the Nuremberg company Ernest Nister. That came back from England to Nuremberg into our museum. Then we have a nice collection of German and English board games from the 1920s to the 1970s. Also a metal construction set collection with about 500 items, boxes as well as models. Then a very special collection of piggy banks, which is an interesting sideline of toys. And then I mentioned that already, the Ernst-Paul Lehmann tin toy collection. And finally, our most recent acquisition, 1,600 Barbie dolls, which must be one of the largest collections in Europe. One final thought. Documenting and cataloging of the collection are important tasks of every serious museum. Only too often, however, these tasks have to be neglected due to lack of time, staff, and money. Catherine has told us about that and how wonderfully they've changed that. We've seen that. At the Nuremberg Toy Museum, we have taken great care to continuously catalogue our collection. In 1994, we started with a digital cataloguing of our stock using professional museum software. Due to the generous funding of this pilot project by the state government and other institutions, we've been able to document about 95% of the toys in our depot so far. With the powerful tool of a nearly complete database, our work has become considerably more efficient in every respect. As a special service to the public, we have published most data of our database on the internet. Our so-called virtual depot can be accessed via the museum's homepage. We started off with some 20,000 objects 10 years ago in 2001, and today this freely researchable database on the internet comprises about 58,000 objects. This museum service is widely used by collectors, students, journalists, and most intensively by museums' colleagues. And eventually we will publish the complete database on the internet. In Germany, we belong to the very few museums that can offer such a service to internet users. And therefore, the Nuremberg Toy Museum was one of the first German museums that was asked to contribute to the internet portal Europeana, which went online in 2008. Thus, we are now part of a project which acts as an interface to millions of books, paintings, films, museums objects, and archival records that have been digitized throughout Europe. Together, Their assembled collections let users explore Europe's cultural and scientific heritage from prehistory to the modern day. We are proud to be part of this ambitious project, and we hope that browsing through our virtual treasures will encourage a personal visit to our museum in the heart of the toy city, Nuremberg.